right. We're in Mark chapter 10, cruising towards Jerusalem. We've dealt with the issue of divorce. We've dealt with the issue of little children, the issue with the rich young ruler, Jesus predicting his death. And right now, we're right in the middle of a discussion between Jesus and two out of the inner three of his disciples, particularly the sons of thunder, on regarding a particularly odd question. The question of, will you let us sit at the right and the left hand when you come into glory? Why is that odd? Or first of all, what is that kind of echo? What is that request, somewhat echo, that's happened just a couple, maybe 20 verses earlier? Who is the greatest? Seems like we're having similar conversations, repeating itself, and it seems like the closer we get to Jerusalem, the dumber the disciples are getting. It's like the things they're requesting in this chapter and a half are just ludicrous in light of where we're headed. And yet, in light of where we're headed, maybe that's why their mind is particularly focused on these things. What we're going to see in this text, what we've already somewhat seen, and what we're going to continue to see, is that Jesus is having to redefine key terms for his disciples. In particular, he's going to be redefining the term glory. What is glory? According to the world, it's defined one way. According to the lens of the disciples of Jesus' kingdom, it should be defined a completely different way. What is power? That's another term we're going to see him redefining. The ways of the world, the definitions of the world, defines the word power one way. But Jesus, in his lens for his kingdom, will be finding it, defining it a completely different way. Ultimately, because everything is being viewed through chapter 10, 32 through 34. Everything's being viewed through the cross from Jesus' perspective. But that is something consistently disciples are not getting. It seems like the more clear Jesus says, this is what's going to happen, the more the disciples say, I have no idea what he's saying. And it's and we've talked about this some, but we'll get to that later. All right, let's start in verse 35. I need to get kind of a running start at this because I think we're in verse 39, but let's start in verse 35. Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, Zebedee's saying, don't throw my name in this, came to him. Teacher, they said, we want you to do for us whatever you ask. That's bold. What do you want me to do for you? He asked. They replied, let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left. In your glory. In your glory. Notice their question, or notice their request. Let one of us sit at your right and at your left in your glory. Because Jesus does respond. He does give them an answer. But I think that they hear both a yes answer and a no answer all at the same time. Which is why they might be more confused. You don't know what you're asking. That is true, Jesus said. Can you drink the cup I drink? Or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with? We can, they answered. Jesus said to them, oh, you will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with. And they may think right there, sweet, he said yes. You see where they get that? Cup is a key symbol for power. Because it's one of the objects, a lot of times, you know, gold laden, that's the close, it's an intimate object with the king. And if you're drinking from the cup of the king, that means that you've got a significant, substantial level of power. And Jesus says, oh, you'll drink from my cup. And they're like, sweet. Well, I mean, my goodness, how far are you going to pass it down the line? Surely we're on the right and the left then. But what's Jesus talking about? Suffering. See, they didn't define the word glory very well. Suffering. We talked about this vaguely at the end of last class. But James in Acts chapter 12, verses 1 through 2, well, it says this. It was about this time that King Herod arrested some who belonged to the church, intending to persecute them. He had James, the brother of John, put to death with the sword. Jesus says, oh, you will drink my cup. You'll drink it. Matter of fact, shoot, it's going to be just 10 years from now, James, that you're going to be beheaded for the gospel around the time of Passover. In honor of one of the Roman prefects, so that he can preserve his own political power. Is this making any connections to anyone? Oh, you'll drink my cup. And John, poor John. John, it didn't matter how many times the people tried to kill him, he just wouldn't die. He watched disciple after disciple, both apostles and followers of Jesus, dying right before him, which I think John did die of old age, which may be sometimes the harder thing to do when you're watching all of your community being persecuted and very unique and, what's the words, creative manners. The disciples' lens, Jesus says, yes, I am going to grant you what you want. But from the lens of the kingdom, glory is defined in a completely different manner. You will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I'm baptized with. But to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared. Now the language of the ones who sit at my right and sit at my left, we will see this exact same language come up in Mark chapter 15, verse 27. Same language. But what is it talking about? What is on the right and the left? That's the language we're going to be seeing. Yeah, it's the thieves or the insurrectionists. The insurrectionists, the laestes. The political revolutionaries that are hanging on the trees next to Jesus. How does that possibly fulfill what their request is talking about? They ask the question, whenever you come into glory, can I sit at your right and your left hand? And Mark seems to parallel Mark chapter 15, verse 27 with this, with the language of right and left. How in that any sense is the right parallel, the correct parallel? Is my question making sense? How can we make that connection of that is the right and the left that they were requesting, but Jesus couldn't grant them? Is this making sense? You guys have Halloween hangover? What's happening? Too much candy? No? Yes?
The Greek words are the same. This is my exegetical topic, and the Greek words are the same. And mm-hmm. There's only like two or three times that those words are used in Mark.
Okay, so absolutely. So linguistically, there's something substantial, especially when there's that small amount of linguistic parallel within the Gospel of Mark, and then they're that exact between those two. Yeah, linguistically, we can make that argument. Absolutely. What about theologically? What about contextually? Let me ask that question. What is their request? I'll keep just asking questions until maybe somebody will answer one of them. What is the key point of their request? What is Jesus responding to in their request? Who's the greatest? Or how do we define glory? Right? Their request is, can we sit at your right and your left when you come into glory? But how are they defining glory? Yeah, whenever you go in, you knock heads together in Jerusalem, sit on your throne. We want to be the one that sits next to you on your right and your left on the throne. Because that's glory, according to the kingdoms of the world. But how has Jesus defined glory just in the text before? What's that? Yes. We are going up to Jerusalem, verse 33, and the Son of Man will be betrayed. Notice the language. Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit on him, flog him and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise. And Jesus says, that's my glory. And they say, no, it's not. It's whenever you're sitting on a big fat throne with gold everywhere and we're sitting next to you. But Jesus uses the honorific language of Son of Man for a reason. Because he's saying, this is my throne. My throne is a cross. That's the problem. That is the issue you guys are not seeing here. Is that the way in which my kingdom reigns, the way in which my kingdom is established, the way in which my kingdom is furthered, is always through a cross. And in essence, this discussion is summing up everything we've been talking about so far. Because this kind of reminds me of Matthew or Mark chapter 9, verse 1, doesn't it? Or 8:36. or 38, if anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels. When does Jesus get the glory? Consistently, he's hammering away. Oh, that sounds like second coming. No, it's not second coming. The glory of Jesus, the reason why we don't see the second, the reason why we force the second coming into everything, it's because we have a hard time seeing glory in the cross. We really do. Whenever we see Son of Man coming into the Father's glory with His angels, we think, oh, that has to be second coming. But it seems pretty clear that the way Jesus is defining glory is through His cross. Because that's what He's been hammering over and over and over the past two chapters. And the disciples don't see it, and a lot of times we have a hard time seeing it too. What is glory? Glory looks like a cross. And that's a difficult thing to swallow, and we've talked about this before. It may even seem foolish. But that's the way the kingdom advances. To sit at my right and my left is not for me to grant. It's actually two random thieves. Doesn't that make sense based off my ministry? That the dregs of society will have the positions of prominence when I'm in my glory. Makes perfect sense. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared. When the ten heard about this, they became indignant with James and John. Yeah, why would they become indignant? Because they want the power. Don't they? They're not upset because they're going, man, you guys just don't get it, do you? Jesus has to die on the cross. You just don't get it. That's not why they're indignant. They're saying, you punks, you asked the question we wanted to ask. We want that glory. We want that power. We want those positions of prominence. And you beat us to the chase. They're upset because they're lusting after something that the other people beat them to the punch. Jesus called them together and said, you know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them, but not so with you. This may be the most blatant, most explicit political contrast or jab at the world and the way in which the world functions than any other verse really in the Gospels. He just comes right out. Everything that has been veiled in the kind of conversation or interaction between Jesus' kingdom and the kingdoms of the world, it comes pretty much to the forefront here. I mean, he flat out, listen to what he says. You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them. Who are the rulers of the Gentiles? What? Yeah, the Romans. Right? I mean, who else are the rulers of the Gentiles? The Romans. He says, you know how they rule. You know how they reign. You know how they define glory. You know how they define power. Why? Because that's the same definitions you're functioning off of while you're talking to me over and over and over and over. He says, you know how they rule. They lord it over them. And their high officials exercise authority over them. They look to subject people under their feet. Pretty fascinating. Sometimes people get upset. And this is one of the reasons why they look for a millennial kingdom where Jesus will reign on earth from a throne for 1,000 years. This is why they look for this. Is because they believe that Jesus needed to reign like that in order for glory and power to be defined accurately. What's ironic about that is they're actually going back to the definition of power and authority that was being wrestled over between God, Samuel, and the people of Israel. Remember with the people of Israel, they come to Samuel and they ask, hey, we want a king. Because until then, they'd been ruled by judges, right? They say, we want a king. And Samuel goes to God, and what does Samuel say? Lord, they've rejected me. I was your agent. I was the one governing them, guiding them, being the mouthpiece of you. And they've rejected me. They want a king. And what does God say back? They've not rejected you. They've rejected me. How did they reject God? By asking for a king to reign on the earth. And God says, you go back to them and you tell them what this king would do to them. Because what this king will do is he will take all their sons and their daughters and their daughters' daughters and their sons' sons, and they will bring them and they will subject them. They will be tilling the soil for the king. They will be fighting wars and dying for wars of the king. They will be subjected to the authority of the king. He will rule over them. He will lord his authority over them. He will oppress them in many ways. You tell them that that is what they will get if they have an earthly king. But that's not what they get with me. Samuel goes and tells them, and what do they say? We want to be like the other nations. Give us a king. And God says, fine. We'll give him a king. And the rest of the Old Testament is playing out of that moment of rebellion. One of the reasons why I think it is ludicrous to think that Jesus would come back and establish a place, a kingdom, with a king ruling on the earth, is because that initial mode of ruling was rejection of God to begin with. So the whole concept of millennial kingdom really doesn't make any sense to me. In the future, I'm going to come and establish this political governance of this kingdom that's ruling on earth from this one key location. Doesn't make any sense to me. Even if it is Jesus as the king. Because ultimately, that whole system is predicated on rebellion against God Himself. The whole system. And Jesus looks at them and He says, you know how Gentiles rule over the Lord. They lord it over them. They oppress them. The same language that we've been talking about since Samuel. This is what they've been doing. And yet you guys are still longing for that position? For that? Don't you want the whole system just to disappear? Why are you just fighting for positions within the same system? And why aren't you longing for the whole system itself to be judged? Jesus says, what I'm giving you, man, it's going to be so much freedom for everybody. Because glory will not be defined the same way. And power will not be defined the same way. Nothing will be defined the same way. The way you rule, the way you advance, the way you fight, nothing's defined the same way. That's so much better than what you're fighting for. It is an incredible principle whenever a lot of times people that are oppressed get into positions of power, a lot of times they just perpetuate the cycle of oppression and violence. And that's what they're longing for, the disciples here. That's what the Jews are longing for. They don't want liberation. They want to become the oppressors. They want to be the ones kicking the enemies in the teeth. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying therefore it is okay for the enemies to be beating them down. But what I am saying is Jesus is judging the entire system. For He says, whenever you come to positions of power, you don't lord it over people, you don't oppress people. You actually use your power to set them free. Why? Because that's what He did. Right? Is this making sense, what I'm saying? The problem isn't who's sitting in the right seats. The problem is the system as a whole. And it's the funny thing is, it's the same system we've had for millennium. We just keep perpetuating the same cycles of oppression, of violence. We just keep pushing it as if something's going to change. It's one of the things that's funny that they teach in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and over and expecting a different result. And it's like, when will we learn that maybe the problem is the entire system, and that the things that we value and the things that we define, maybe they all just need a complete revamp. Maybe we need to go back pre-Samuel to the time where literally, we just relied on God to rule us. And He would arise people and He would call on people at His whim to guide us in the directions that He needed us to move. But we want a king. We want to be like the rest of the nations. We want a king. I'm thankful that Jesus didn't perpetuate that system. And instead, He's reigning once again from heaven. And through His Holy Spirit, He arises the people at the different times, at the different places to accomplish His purposes. We can fight against that system, or we can act like that it's actually the way to not be in rebellion against God. Is this making sense? The whole system's the problem. And that's what Jesus is pointing out. You know the way these Gentiles rule. You know the way they rule. They lord it over each other. They look for power and authority and glory so then they can lord it over people. And the reason why you're upset at the Pharisees is not because they're oppressing people, but it's because they have the positions you want. That's the problem. Not so with you, verse 43. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. He said this before, has He not? Where has He said this before? What? Mark chapter 9, verse 35. He says, they ask who is the greatest? And Jesus says, if anyone wants to be first, he must be the very last and the servant of all. He also says this somewhere else. Similar. Just 12 verses earlier, isn't it? Mark 10:31. After the rich young ruler teaching, Jesus says, but many who are first will be last, and the last will be first. Why does He keep throwing the same teaching in? Why would He keep throwing this in? Maybe He's trying to make sure they don't get the wrong idea at the triumphal entry. Maybe. That's possible. What else? What else? Why would He keep hammering this home?
They haven't gotten it yet.
Yeah, maybe it's just because they're just still dumb and they haven't gotten it yet. What's that?
It's really important.
Yeah, it gets really important. Somebody else was going to say a similar thing. I don't know who it was. What were you going to say? Yeah, I heard an illustration once. I don't know where it came from. It may be tried at this point, but it fits here. There was an old minister at a church. And he'd been there for 30 years. And the church was going through a lot of turmoil, a lot of bickering over things. And one Sunday morning, he gets up. And he gets up to preach his sermon. Same system, you know. The worship leader finishes his four songs and says a quaint little prayer, and then it's the time for the minister to get up. So the minister, you know, gets up. He gets in the pulpit and he looks at him and he just says, "Love one another." And he just kind of looks around, closes his Bible, goes and sits down in the front pew. And, you know, the worship minister is like, shortest sermon ever? You know, like, what do I do here? So after about, you know, 3 minutes of just awkwardness, the worship minister gets up there and leads the invitation and they dismiss. Everybody was like, you know, he's getting old. Maybe he thought he preached the whole sermon. And, you know, whatever. We'll give him a pass. No big deal. Next Sunday, worship minister comes up, does the four songs, quaint little prayer. Minister gets up. Gets in the pulpit, and this time a little bit teary-eyed, looks at him and he says, "Love one another." Closes his Bible and sits down in the front pew. This time the worship minister is a little bit more akin to what's happening here, and so he just takes 60 seconds this time, and after a little bit of awkwardness, he gets up there, leads the closing hymn, and is like, "All right, you're dismissed." People at this point are going, "Man, he's lost it. Something's not right with him. Maybe he's feeling sick. Maybe he's not having time to prepare. Maybe he's just tired." Next Sunday comes, worship leader does four songs, quaint little prayer. The guy gets up there, says, "Love one another." And this time he's just weeping. Closes his Bible and goes and sits down. Well, the worship leader doesn't even miss a beat this time. He just gets up, leads the closing song, and you know they pray and let out. Well, this time, though, they let out, and like all good churches, they have a board meeting, emergency board meeting. We got to figure out what's wrong with this guy. So they call him in and they're just railing on him. We have got to have more meat than this. You're just saying one line. Your sermons have got to be at least 15 minutes. I mean, give us a devotional. Like, you know, but we're not going to keep paying you if this is what you're going to be doing. I mean, why in the world do you just keep saying, love one another and sitting down? And the minister looked at him and he says, you want meat. He says, but until we get this down, we can't move on. And he says, and look around. It's the one thing that we don't understand. And that seems to be what Jesus is doing here. Jesus, why are you saying the same thing over and over and over? The first to be last, the last to be first. The one who must be, you know, the least who wants to be first must be last and the servant of all. Why do you keep saying this over and over and over? Because if you don't get this, the whole kingdom doesn't make sense. If you don't get this, your definition of glory, your definition of power, the definition of how you fight, everything will be backwards. But he's laying down a very clear kingdom that is not easy to accept. But it's not because he's not articulating it clearly. It's not because he's not giving you enough time to digest it. It's because you refuse to acknowledge what he is saying very clearly. You want to follow me, pick up your stinking cross. That's what he's saying, is it not? He's saying the way in which I come into my glory is whenever they hand me over to be killed, when they hang me on a tree, and then I rise again. And he says, and do you think your glory is defined any different? You act like it is. You act like you've got everything in control. Down to protecting yourself and your family. Down to providing for your own food and shelter. You've got it all under control. You fight for your positions of glory and power. And I'll give you a kingdom that judges the whole system. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the king... For even the Son of Man, notice the language, did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. There's a how much more Jewish principle in that verse. You catch it, right? For if the King of the universe, the one that created anything, the one that actually has a legitimate claim to the power and glory that is defined by this world. If the King of Glory came here not to be served, but to serve, how much more should you? I mean, what's your excuse? The things that will divide churches, the things that will destroy marriages, the things that will even cause strife in your dorms is people that forget this how much more principle. You didn't come to Ozark to be served. And I know many of you, in a sense, even feel that way. You don't get the opportunities in your life so that you can be served with more glory and honor. You get them so that you can become a servant to all and leverage whatever power you have, not to lord it over people, but to bring people up to your position. To give them more opportunities than you ever had. It's something really that Mark Morris taught me. Unbelievably. I mean, I tell Mark all the time. I mean, I he definitely is my earthly patron. I tell him all the time. I was like, whether I'm talking spiritually or occupationally or ministry, you just name it. I owe you. Because you've held nothing back. You've given me everything. And I'm not going to forget that. I'm going to make sure that because you served me, that buddy, you're going to be getting served by me as much as I can. And that's why sometimes people will be like, oh man, you're running off copies for Mark. You know, are you still his lackey? You're darn right I'm still his lackey. Why would I not be? I don't understand why that's a negative thing that I go get coffee for Mark Moore. Why would I not do that? Shoot, he does it for me. Just ask my Christology class. The Son of Man didn't come to be served. How much more do you think you ever arrive? There's a part of me that I'm very thankful of the opportunities like that I've had to go to Edinburgh and things like that. And there's part of me that hates it. Because people just get the wrong idea that that's what we should be striving for. It's like I was rebuking my Acts class whenever I was telling them, the professors are really your heroes? You treat us like rock stars, and for what reason? Really? Whenever there's people that are laying their lives down for the gospel every single day, we're the ones that you want to be like? Man, don't sell yourself short. Please don't sell the kingdom short. Have bigger aspirations than to be a professor. The only reason why this job's even valuable to me is because I know that you guys are going to be doing the things that I would give up this job in a heartbeat to be doing. But for some reason, the Lord's not allowed me to yet. But there will be a day, and my wife and I have talked about it, we're looking forward to it, where we will revel in the obscurity of serving the least of these. Some people's exile is different looking than other people's. And there's part of me that feels like this one's mine, but I'm okay with it as long as I'm being faithful to the Lord. But we've got to make sure we're defining power and glory and prominence in the right ways. It was like I was talking to Jeff Snell the other day about rewards in heaven. I'm going to fight that there's rewards in heaven because I want Dr. Lowry and I want Mark Moore and anybody that's been beaten for the gospel to get way more rewards than me. And I'm going to petition the pearly gates for them to get it. And say, really, Jesus, you're going to treat me the exact same way as Paul? Really? The exact same way as Peter and John? I don't think so. The exact same way as Mark and as Dr. No, not going to happen. I don't want it to happen. We're all in heaven. I'm good. That's all I needed. They need to be honored in a different way than me. It's like, if the Son of Man did not come to be served, but He came to serve, how much more? How much more should you be? And how did He come to be served? To give His life as a ransom for many. He's saying the same thing over and over and over. The cross is the definition of my glory. The cross is the definition of my power. And if you're walking this journey, if you're running this race without your cross, you're not following Jesus. That's why I love this bracelet that this youth group made for me. 1 John 2:6. If you claim to follow Him, you must walk in the way in which Jesus walked. That's what 1 John 2:6 says, and that's exactly right. How did He walk? With the cross latched on His back down the Via Dolorosa. Then they came to Jericho, verse 46. Jericho. What are you thinking if you're a Jew and you're astute in Jewish history when they come to Jericho, which is why we have our handy-dandy map up here. Notice they started up in Galilee, they cross over the Jordan, hop down to Samaria, and then go to Jericho. What's significant about Jericho? Yeah. After Moses passes on, Joshua takes over the reign of the kingdoms, of the kingdom. Kingdom. They cross over, and the first victory in the promised land was Jericho. And when they come to when Jesus comes to Jericho, what do you think that the disciples, that maybe the people following Him, have in mind? Oh, buddy. No, oh, I know why He went to Jericho. Because He's going to start knocking heads together and developing our promised land. Maybe they thought the people in Jericho themselves would receive some of the wrath. Or maybe they thought at the least this is where He'd be recruiting some of the main soldiers. Because Jericho is only, 13 miles? 13 miles away from Jerusalem. They know where they're headed. They're headed right to Jerusalem, where the kingdom is supposed to be established. And Jericho is an important stop along the way, because this is the first stop of the promised land. Then they came to Jericho. As Jesus and his disciples, together with a large crowd, were leaving the city, a blind man, Bartimaeus, that is the son of Timaeus, was sitting by the roadside begging. This scene will function in a couple of different ways. Number one, this will be another sign act. We've been talking about these. The healing of the deaf mute in chapter 7. Then the healing of the blind man, blind man in chapter 8. And then now once again we see the healing of the blind Bartimaeus, where this healing will be a way of gauging the spiritual vitality, in a sense, of the disciples. But another way that it functions is this stands in direct contrast to the rich young ruler. Everything about this scene contrasts the rich young ruler. And I've listed myself about four different ways that I see this contrasting. Number one, the economic status of the beggar, of the blind Bartimaeus, and of the rich young ruler is clearly in contrast. The rich young ruler, I mean, it was mentioned that he was rich, but even in chapter 10, verse 22, it says, he went away sad because he had great wealth. But in chapter 10, verse 46, Bartimaeus is begging. Economically, they're worlds apart. Number two, the rich man is revered by the disciples, by people in society, where the blind man is shunned. So sociologically, they are worlds apart as well. What we're going to see here in just a minute is then Bartimaeus keeps wanting to talk to Jesus. He keeps getting rebuked by the crowd just to shut up. Why? Because you are worthless in society. Therefore, don't talk to the king. Number three, now this is where it starts to get a little interesting. Notice that Mark's gospel never records a name for the rich young ruler. But he does record a name of the begging blind man named Bartimaeus. We even get his dad's name. Mark is saying something subtly there about what is valued in the kingdom. And ultimately, it culminates in this key contrast. The rich man lacks faith and therefore does not follow Jesus. Bartimaeus, because of his faith, is not only healed, but the text actually uses the word, and he followed Jesus in verse 52. These two scenes are set up surrounding the scene in the middle to show a contrast. This, the rich young ruler, through that lens, is the way you're defining power and honor and value and everything, glory, prosperity. Bartimaeus is the way I wish you were seeing the world. And the irony of it is that he is blind. But a lot of times people with blindness in the Gospels and in Acts can see things most clearly, which is one of the reasons why I think that Saul was blinded before he became Paul, because it was whenever he was blind that he was able to see more clearly spiritually. Verse 47, when he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to shout, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." What do you notice? Son of David, that's huge. That's king language. What do you notice though? When he heard from the crowds, he asked, what's happening? Why? Because he can't see. When he says, what's happening? He hears that Jesus of Nazareth is coming. What do you notice?
He began to shout.
What's that?
He began to shout.
Say it again.
He began to shout.
He began to shout? Absolutely. But what does he begin to shout? Jesus of Nazareth, have mercy on me. He actually switches it. The people say, oh, it's Jesus of Nazareth. Nazareth. Remember, when's the last time we heard Nazareth? Chapter, 6. Where Jesus is what? Rejected by his own people. He asked the crowds because he cannot see, who's coming? It's Jesus of Nazareth. And he says, no, it's not. Jesus, Son of David. Bartimaeus sees clearly. The crowds don't. There is a shift, a distinct shift in what the crowds call Jesus in Jericho and what Bartimaeus calls Jesus. Jesus, King, have mercy on me. Many rebuked him. Why are they rebuking him? Maybe because he is a drag of society, he needs to shut up. Or maybe because they don't agree with what he just yelled at Jesus. Text doesn't really give us a clear indication. But the same word used for rebuke there is the same word in Mark chapter 8, 32 when Peter pulls Jesus aside and says, "Jesus, you're not going to die." And he rebukes him. Same word. All this is attached to how we define glory, honor, power, etc. They rebuke him and tell him to be quiet. But he shouted all the more, "Son of David, have mercy on me." I wonder if he started chanting, you know, "Son of David, have mercy on me. Son of David, have mercy." You know what I mean? He's like, "I will not shut up. This is the King. This is the King." Jesus stopped and said, "Call him." And they're like, "Oh, geez." So they called to the blind man, "Cheer up, on your feet, he's calling you." Throwing his cloak aside, he jumped to his feet and came to Jesus, or probably was led to Jesus. "What do you want me to do for you?" Jesus asked him. Isn't that ironic? What's ironic in that question? Yeah? Yeah, Jesus is the servant? Doesn't it sound like the same question that the disciples asked to Jesus? They say, "We want you to do whatever you ask for us." And Jesus says, "What do you want me to do for you?" Jesus looks at the blind man and he says, "What do you want me to do for you?" And their requests could not be more opposite. Why? Because how they define Jesus could not be more opposite. It's identity. The blind man said, "Rabbi, I want to see." "Go," said Jesus, "your faith has healed you." How do we define faith? Is that internal barometer that we, you know, if we get it up high enough, then God will do whatever we want because we've handcuffed him? How do we define faith? Yes, the acknowledgement and submission to the power and identity of Jesus. That's faith. And Bartimaeus, who is told Jesus of Nazareth is coming, could not stop screaming, "Son of David, Son of David, Son of David." Immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus along the road. The only way you can truly follow Jesus is if you understand who he is. And sometimes you have to be stinking literally blind in order to truly see who he is spiritually. Some of you are going to have the most amazing opportunities come your way. It actually kind of broke my heart the other day whenever I heard in a faculty meeting that there weren't a lot of people signed up for the seminar on how to minister in a small church. And my thought was, because no one thinks they're going to be in a small church. That's why. No one thinks they'll be there. Everybody thinks they're going to have the next Southeast. Because that's when you know you've arrived. When you get those types of opportunities, make sure God doesn't have to physically blind you before you see him for who he truly is. For if the Son of Man did not come here to be served, how much more? You'll be even tempted to say inside of your ministries, "You know what? I didn't go to 4 years of Bible college and get my master's degree so that I could be working in the nursery. I didn't get all this education so I could be changing diapers." And as Jeff Snell said once in a sermon back in 2003, "Oh yes, you did. Yeah, you did. Who do you think you are?" Thinking that that type of ministry is below you. If that's what you've learned since you have been here, you have wasted your time, my time, and a lot of money. Because if you learn anything at this school, it's that you don't get any opportunities you receive so that you can be served, but so you can serve other people. And if you don't get that through your thick head, I hope Jesus doesn't have to blind you. Does that make sense? Don't be like Saul, be like Paul. Or Bartimaeus. Love you guys. See you in the morning.